It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. conflict with Iran crosses the 100-day mark with more active conflict this week. Congress passes a bill funding immigration enforcement, and the president nominates a new attorney general.
We're checking in with Wisconsin's U.S. senators on those issues.
Yesterday, I talked to Wisconsin Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin. Well, over 100 days into this war with Iran, you've called it an illegal war of choice in the past. What do you want to see from the White House to resolve this?
Yeah, first of all, we passed the 100-day mark last weekend, and it's important to take stock of where we are right now. Iran still has its nuclear materials. It has basically the same regime in place. One might argue it maybe even be more hardline. And the Strait of Hormuz is still, for all purposes, closed. We've accomplished nothing except for higher prices for Americans. It's already estimated that the average family in America has spent $750 just in the past 100 days to meet the rising costs of Trump's wars. Think in terms of filling your gas tank and the higher cost of groceries and all the things that we're seeing. The inflation numbers this week are staggering. And I've led an effort to bring the Senate to vote to end this war almost weekly since this war began. And my Republican colleagues really have a choice. And we've put that choice to them on a weekly basis. Support this war, the president, and these higher costs, or stand with the American people who want this war to end and vote to end it. We're gaining momentum as time goes on with these weekly votes. And last week, the House even followed suit with what we're doing in the Senate and passed on a bipartisan basis a resolution to end the war. Unfortunately, Wisconsin's Republican congressional delegation voted to keep Trump's war going. But we're trying to put everyone on record and bring this war to an end.
Speaking of those costs, especially as they affect farmers, President Trump was in Chippewa County last week saying, acknowledging, yes, input costs like fertilizer and fuel were up. He made the case, here's a listen, saying this is temporary.
Fertilizer prices are going to go way down, just like they were 4 months ago. Your fertilizer's down, your energy's down, your oil, your gas is all coming way down.
These are temporary price increases, the president says. Your response, Senator.
Well, the president said a lot when he was in Chippewa Falls. He talked a lot about his reflecting pool in Washington, D.C. He also said he didn't really even understand why he should have to be there. And basically was asking our farmers to ignore the reality around them. I've visited about six farms in the last month or so, farms of all sorts, livestock, corn, soy, dairy farms, to really gauge how they're doing in this environment. You know, diesel fuel hit its highest point ever in Wisconsin last month, $5.80 per gallon. And I asked the farmers that I visited, how much fuel does your tractor hold? 100 gallons. How about that combined? 300 gallons. If they didn't forward contract, a lot of them don't have the money right now to fill their tanks for planting season. And then fertilizer? Many of our farmers are having to do without the full complement of fertilizer that they need for their fields. This is going to have ramifications for months and months to come. And our farmers work harder than anyone I know. So, you know, there may be a glitzy rally that the president holds in Wisconsin, but that does nothing to deal with the real harm our farmers and ultimately the American consumers of their products will have to deal with.
Turning to immigration and the federal budget, you and Democratic colleagues have been blocking funding for Immigration and Customs Enforcement and related agencies. Republicans now have used the reconciliation process to be able to pass that without that filibuster to block it. Was the effort worth it, given that you've ended up in the same place? These agencies are funded through the remainder of President Trump's presidency.
Well, I think what we just saw was truly an outrage. Look, we have seen this president surge lawless ICE agents and Border Patrol agents into cities across America. We saw up close what happened in the Twin Cities in Minnesota when masked, armed, unidentified agents just patrolled, roving patrols in residential neighborhoods, in churches, outside schools, outside health clinics. They killed two American citizens. And we insisted that there be common sense rules put in place, the same sort of rules that our local police officers have to obey. This is common sense. The Wisconsinites that I heard from during the surge in Minnesota were outraged to see what was happening in America and demanded that we do everything we can to put these rules in place. My Republican colleagues not only refused to do that in advancing this budget reconciliation bill that funds ICE agents and Border Patrol agents, but they also refused to put an end to Donald Trump's effort to create a slush fund to pay out $1.8 billion to convicted felons and others who participated in the January 6th insurrection. These are outrages. We should all be appalled by what we're seeing, and we should all be holding those who supported that legislation accountable.
We're talking to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. This week, President Trump formally nominated his former personal lawyer, Todd Blanche, to serve as the nation's next attorney general. What concerns would you raise about that nominee?
Well, the nominee has expressed his complete fealty and loyalty to Donald Trump. At times, above the law, his loyalty to Donald Trump seems to be a higher priority. And that is not acceptable. He said that he would consider himself still to be, in many ways, Donald Trump's lawyer in this role. And that's something that we should press against. He was also, at first, the biggest advocate for this $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund, as they call it, sort of came forth with this idea as a settlement of another case that Donald Trump had lodged against his own government. This is just a corrupt outrage, and anybody whose fingerprints are on that is not fit, in my mind, to be the United States Attorney General.
We're, of course, in an election year. The Trump administration has been pushing various forms of what's been called the SAVE Act. It would put federal controls over a lot of things that are currently done by state, including requiring particular proofs of citizenship for people registering to vote. This is something that Democrats and some Republicans have been blocking. It's not vulnerable to reconciliation. President Trump has said the Senate parliamentarian should be fired for not allowing changes like that to be made without that filibuster as an option. Do you see this SAVE Act affecting federal elections in the country moving forward in any way?
I will do everything I can to defeat it. And I believe that we can do so because of the Senate rules. This is an effort, as the president has said he wants to do, to nationalize elections. In Wisconsin, we run very effective, fair elections. We rely on local clerks across our states, hundreds of them, to do their jobs, and they provide accurate and fairly timely results on our elections. And so any effort to nationalize them is really an insult to the great job that we do in a state like Wisconsin. But it has some really foreboding implications. The idea that you have to come in person in order to register, to show documents that many U.S. citizens don't have, like passports, birth certificates. Those are not things that everybody has at the tip of their fingers. And, you know, this combined with other efforts the president has put forward, the seizure of old ballots in Georgia, the continual denial of the outcome of the 2020 election, his efforts through the Postal Service to create some national database of who's eligible to vote by mail. This should scare every citizen, and we've got to fight back and make sure that our elections are safe, fair, and timely, like we have in the state of Wisconsin and had throughout time.
Briefly, as we wrap up, you've been pushing for the release of the leader of Wisconsin's largest mosque, Salah Sansour, detained by immigration authorities. Where do those efforts stand now?
You know, our efforts to call attention to both his detention under questionable circumstances as a 30-year resident of the United States, but also our efforts to call attention to the fact that he has diabetes and requires medical care in the facility that he's in that he is not currently getting. So far, we have not heard an adequate response, in my mind, from the Department of Homeland Security and its new secretary, Mullen. I want assurances that he is getting the health care that he needs to maintain his health with diabetes. And frankly, he needs to have a hearing as soon as possible and should be released back into the community where he is viewed widely as a leader in Wisconsin.
Senator Baldwin, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Tammy Baldwin, Democratic U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. An interview with Republican Senator Ron Johnson is scheduled to air tomorrow here on the show.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a manufacturing boom set off by AI data centers awarding contracts to businesses in Wisconsin. What could be the impact?
It is going to be enormous, and there is this so-called second order, third order supply chain effects that we are going to see.
A look at businesses set to profit from hyperscale data centers, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin fish and wildlife regulators say there's little that can be done to reverse cuts to fish stocking and the closure of two fish hatcheries. Some anglers say the cuts are the result of a political vendetta between Governor Tony Evers and Republican lawmakers.
As Danielle Kading reports, the DNR says a lack of authority to spend funds forced the closures.
As water laps along a Lake Superior bay, Todd Berg recalls fishing with his wife last spring at nearby Houghton Falls, hoping to catch enough coho salmon for dinner.
One of our light rods went off and went off and went off to a point that I thought it was a snag. And it ended up 20 minutes later being a 32-inch brown trout.
Brown trout are stocked into Lake Superior to benefit anglers like Berg. Last year, Wisconsin stocked 372,000 brown trout into Lakes Superior and Michigan that were reared at the nearly century-old Brule State Fish Hatchery. But now, the facility sits empty. This spring, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources announced the closure of the Brule and Osceola State Fish Hatcheries, along with deep cuts to fish stocking. Berg blames the cuts and closures on a political vendetta. He's a representative of the newly formed group Friends of the Wisconsin Fisheries. He pointed to federal data that shows boating and fishing generate around $1 billion for Wisconsin's economy.
The state brings in a tremendous amount of money from people who visit here that want to go out and fish. Why would we cut our own throats?
The DNR had asked the legislature's budget writing committee for authority to spend $4 million under the state's Fish and Wildlife account by April 12th to avoid the cuts. Lawmakers approved the funds a month later. By then, the agency said it was too little, too late. Water flows into a concrete tank where 18-month-old brown trout dart back and forth as Darren Miller stands nearby at the Les Voigt State Fish Hatchery. He supervises operations at the facility and the Brule Hatchery for the Wisconsin DNR. These yearlings hatched around Christmas in 2024, and agency staff say they plan fish stocking 2 years out. Miller says the DNR faces tight timelines to collect eggs from fish while they're spawning.
We operate on what Mother Nature does, and there's a narrow window when she's supplying our eggs and that we need for our production.
While lawmakers approved the DNR's request, agency staff say walleyes and muskies had already spawned, and it's unlikely they could obtain fish from private hatcheries to meet stocking quotas. The cuts come as Wisconsin's Fish and Wildlife account faces an ongoing $11 million shortfall. Lawmakers transferred $30 million from the state's forestry account under the current two-year state budget to make up for falling revenue. Republican State Senator Romaine Quinn of Birchwood faulted the agency for providing little notice before making the cuts.
I hope we can learn from this, and I don't believe there's anyone on the Finance Committee, let alone either party, that want to see cuts to stocking the state.
Hunting and fishing license fees make up the Fish and Wildlife account's main source of revenue. For more than 20 years, resident fees haven't been increased, and license sales have largely been on the decline. At the same time, Adina Rissman says inflation has driven costs up more than 70%. She's a professor of natural resources policy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Agencies can make do for a little while with flat budgets, but after decades of cuts and budgets not keeping up with inflation, they just end up doing less. And this means less of what hunters, anglers, and all people outdoors want.
Anglers like Berg support raising resident license fees, but Republicans rejected fee increases under the current state budget. Lawmakers say they were waiting on results of an audit ordered to examine the DNR's handling of the account's funds. Last August, the state's nonpartisan Legislative Audit Bureau found the agency was appropriately spending that money. Besides raising fees, conservation groups have suggested backfilling the account with state money or generating revenue through a sales tax similar to those used by Missouri and Minnesota. But a long-term solution to the financial shortfall won't stop the disruption in fish stocking this year. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News. Two Wisconsin companies recently signed deals to supply critical components to new data centers. They represent big contracts coming to Wisconsin companies in a rapidly developing sector.
Waukesha-based Generac announced an agreement to provide backup power generators for an unnamed hyperscale data operator.
And Racine-based Modine Manufacturing announced it has entered a $4 billion contract to provide cooling systems for an unnamed data center customer.
To learn more, Wisconsin Watch reporter Tom Kircher is with us. Tom, welcome back.
Thanks, Kate. Appreciate it.
And Dejo Alexander is with us, professor of practice at Lubar College of Business at UW-Milwaukee, specializing in technology management, digital transformation, and AI. Dejo, welcome.
Thank you so much, Kate. Happy to be here.
Tom, starting with you, companies like Google, like Microsoft, are developing data centers in Wisconsin. And there is this whole economic infrastructure, this whole supply chain that is going up as well in support of these facilities. And you've reported on some of the business growth that's underway. What Wisconsin businesses are landing major contracts from the AI data center industry?
Yeah, at least three that are doing so in a big way. There's a company called Regal Rexnord in Milwaukee that makes motors. There's Generac in Waukesha outside of Milwaukee that makes generators. And in Racine, there's a company called Modine that makes cooling systems. The story I did took a look at how much data center business those companies are doing. And just the three of them, at least as of March, had done more than $1 billion worth of data center business.
Do you continue to see these contracts landing with Wisconsin companies months later?
There are more. Yeah, Generac just announced the other day another contract, and so has Modine. Modine said that it has a $4 billion deal with a data center operator that it did not identify. Generac 2 announced that it made a global agreement to supply backup power generators, again, to an unidentified data center operator. They didn't put a dollar figure on that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that even before hyperscale data centers are up and running in Wisconsin, that Wisconsin businesses are benefiting.
Dijo, what do you make of this activity? At least $46 billion worth of data centers under construction or being planned in Wisconsin. What kind of businesses feed into that development?
It is going to be enormous. Essentially, we are starting with the compute cluster, and there is this so-called second-order, third-order supply chain effects that we are going to see. Unlike many other states, Wisconsin already has a manufacturing base. This not only attracts local businesses to supply to our data centers coming up in our neighborhood, but also expose these companies to opportunities outside the state.
Generac and Modine, I mean, they'll be located near some of these massive data centers they'll be providing these products for. How important, Dijo, is proximity and just-in-time logistics in awarding contracts for cooling, for instance?
Cooling is one of the most important thing, and also cooling is a field where technology is going to advance in the next 3 to 5 years. So right now, most of the data centers are going through air cooling systems. It is completely going to change to liquid cooling. And that is exactly why companies, data center companies, are attracted to Wisconsin with our large pool of fresh water. And this technology itself is emerging. And I hope companies like Modine will be able to participate in this advancement in technology to provide not only the liquid cooling systems, but also the chip, direct-to-chip cooling, which are all emerging, still emerging. And proximity is a big thing. You get to participate in these discussions upfront, initially itself, and then slowly but surely expand into other regions and get global exposure.
I wonder, too, whether, you know, Generac and Modine, for instance, they do business around the world. They're multinationals. But are the smaller companies getting in on this yet? Are they landing deals with these up-and-coming AI data centers?
They are. When I did a story about the three companies making more than $1 billion worth of business on data center work, you know, we also included an example of a much smaller company called Modular Power and Data, not a household name, but they do have about 90 employees in Dane County and in Milwaukee County. And that company talked about the fact that in 2025, it did $10 million worth of data center business. And the expectation was that figure will more than double this year.
We're talking about which Wisconsin businesses are set to profit off the development of data centers in the state. That is Tom Kircher, reporter with Wisconsin Watch, and Dijo Alexander is here, professor of practice at Lubar College of Business at UW-Milwaukee. Dijo, massive developments like the Mount Pleasant data center from Microsoft can possibly create what you've called a tech corridor. What might that look like?
That is the ecosystem play that we have to imagine. The data center itself is going to be the center of this whole thing. And also, we keep hearing that there are going to be only limited full-time employees there. That is true. But the effect of all these things being at the center is going to create a lot more activities around this thing. There are a lot of examples of these around the world, and simple cases like Ashburn or the Loudoun County in Virginia is, for example, is currently the data center capital of the world. And that is also, by the way, the wealthiest county in the whole country. So there is a reason why these data centers attract a lot more activities around it, all the way from, especially with this being an AI-centered investment, there is a lot of fight going to be closer to these data centers, because
at the end of the day, how quickly you can get the inference out and saving a few milliseconds is going to be the key sometimes in the future when it comes to all these high-frequency trading and those kind of decision-making within a few milliseconds. And being closer to Milwaukee and attracting that kind of activities down the line, businesses to the area, with that, a lot more opportunities, especially in the tech field for employment. And this is not going to happen overnight. We have time. We have 2 to 3 years, and this is going to be the time to prepare for it, plan for it, and educate our workforce and get them ready for this opportunity that is coming.
So it sounds like you see Wisconsin being positioned to become this AI infrastructure supply chain hub for the Midwest. Is that what you see?
Absolutely. This is a great opportunity. Our unique positioning is the first and foremost is the fresh water. But then we also, being in Midwest, we have the deep manufacturing base in order to support this kind of construction and then further maintenance and activities, ongoing activities. Then we have the university system here. This is going to be the feeder for not only we need a lot of science to be discovered at this point to support some of these necessary things going on in the data center and also AI space in general. And then our geographic location is amazing. We are in the center of the country, and always think about this. This is all about movement of photons and electrons, the digital age of moving information from one end of the country to the other end. And we are at the center, feeding across East Coast and West Coast. And we have a lot of advantages going. And this is a time to feel that power in our minds and act with an approach of understanding that value to negotiate better.
Using that leverage. Tom, turning back to you, you have written that hyperscale data centers can often bring the new construction jobs, but they are temporary jobs. Are the jobs created at these other companies that provide services, that provide the equipment for data centers, the maintenance over their lifespan, are these longer lasting than construction jobs?
You know, I think that remains to be seen. The construction jobs, to be fair, they're temporary, certainly, but we're talking about many months or even more than a year to build a hyperscale data center. And so there is a big impact from construction. I was just talking actually today to the Port Washington mayor, and he talked about the impact there already. He said there are as many as 2,000 construction workers in Port Washington every day, and those people are spending money to stay in an Airbnb and going to the grocery store and going to restaurants. And so, you know, a big impact for an extended period of time. In terms of the companies that are supplying the data centers, I think the expectation would be that that would be a lasting project, right? The data centers will continue to need generators, will continue to need cooling systems. You know, that being said, this is all pretty new frontier, right? And the expectation is data centers will be a big part of the economy, will be around a long time, but we don't know. And certainly there's a possibility that some of these data centers are constructed and maybe they don't turn out to be as successful as expected. And obviously, if that were the case, that would affect the suppliers too.
Dijo, in this uncertainty, what could lawmakers or Wisconsin officials do to make sure communities do get the most out of this new industry and do, are stewards to the resources that they have?
This is a time to negotiate and be at the table. We have to understand the value that we are providing. I mean, these data centers need our water, land, our power grid, and workers. And of course, we need their investment, research partnership, the supply chain demand, and we have to talk to them and arrive at legally binding agreements where it is long-lasting, and also the investments necessary has to be kind of coming from all sides, if not from the larger consumers of electricity, in this case, the data centers. And these are not small companies that are coming in. They are companies that have deep pockets. And it is just a matter of negotiating, working with them the word that you use, the stewardship, instead of ownership of this water and the resources that we have. We are just stewards, and we have to be watchful and protective of the of these resources for the future generations too.
I think one thing to watch for is to see whether, as people become more aware of the economic impact of data centers, does their opinion of data centers change? So polls nationwide have consistently found that Americans feel that data centers have more downsides than good sides, so to speak. And in Wisconsin, when there's a data center proposed, there's often opposition that's quickly mobilized. You know, Facebook groups start out, rallies are held. There's a lot of visible opposition. I think it'll be interesting to watch as people learn more about companies perhaps near them who are benefiting from data center work. Be interesting to see if their opinions about data centers shift.
Dijo and Tom, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. You're welcome, Kate.
That is Dijo Alexander, a professor of practice at Lubar College of Business at UW-Milwaukee, and Tom Kircher, a journalist with Wisconsin Watch. We've been talking about how Wisconsin manufacturers are seizing on new business opportunities with the rise of AI data centers in Wisconsin.
Coming up, a Madison area death worker is hoping to help people build a healthy relationship with death and grief, opening a space for educational workshops and support.
What's required to tend to grief is kind of the opposite of what we are told to do within a capitalist culture, which is go, go, go.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Everyone will experience death, but in American culture, death and dying are often taboo topics that people shy away from. Megan Johnson of Madison wants to change that.
As a professional artist, she uses creativity to help people work through grief and death.
And this summer, she plans to open the Madison Death Studio and Bookshop, where she'll provide workshops and support to people experiencing death and dying.
Megan Johnson is a death worker and founder of Madison Death Studio. Megan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I understand you came to this concept of being a death worker through some personal experiences of your own and the loss of your family at an earlier age than we'd like to see. Can you tell us a little bit about what led you there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had experienced caregiving for two terminally ill parents who were both diagnosed with different terminal illnesses in my 20s while I was in undergraduate here at the UW-Madison for an art degree. And I went on to continue my career in art and also managed caregiving for them and supporting them emotionally through the process of the terminal illnesses that they had. And after getting my art degree, I moved to New York City, continued to support them and travel back and forth from New York to Madison. And both of them passed away when I was in my early mid-30s, within 18 months of one another.
And in that peer age group, that's not something everybody's dealing with. Was that kind of a lonely, maybe even isolating experience?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone was really kind to me and listened to me through that process, but I could really tell that it was difficult to have those conversations around loss, especially, like you said, in that peer age group where other folks that I knew and was talking to hadn't really experienced the same thing.
And this isn't something we're necessarily real good about talking about in the first place, right? As I'm sure you encounter in your work, if there's a stereotype of us in the U.S., we don't like, I think, to talk about death and to share our grieving process and things like that. What do you see when it comes to that reluctance to tackle this?
Yeah, I think it's a difficult culture for grief. I mean, in some ways, I feel like this culture is quite hostile to folks who are grieving or folks who are ill or dying, because it is what's required to tend to grief is kind of the opposite of what we are told to do within a capitalist culture, which is go, 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 and, you know, pull yourself up and all of that stuff.
And we'll dig into that a little more. But I want to get into this concept of a death worker. Mm-hmm. People might be familiar with a grief therapist, maybe death doulas. They're out there and people might have heard of that. This idea of being a death worker, what is that?
Yeah, so I identify as a death worker, not as a death doula. And the reason why I have chosen to do that is that death doula has kind of been defined at this stage as somebody who does work at the bedside of those who are having often predicted deaths. So folks who are there to support the hospice process or folks who are there to support the family and the caregivers during that hospice process. And what I do that work. I do. And the reason why I'm choosing the word death worker is that it is a more umbrella term. And a lot of the work, the bulk of the work that I do is actually around culture shifting. So I know we'll get into this a little bit more when we talk about the Madison Death Studio and Bookstore. But in order for the folks in our culture who might need these services to know that they're out there, we also need to change our culture and talk about it on a broader scale as well. So that's the kind of death work that I'm mostly focused on.
What is the Madison Death Studio?
Right. So the Madison Death Studio up until now was sort of an online and conceptual space to talk about death and grief and to create some cultural education around community-based death care. I also had been hosting workshops at other locations, Art Lit Lab, Goodman Community Center, things like that. And now I have my own studio workshop and bookshop on Atwood Avenue.
So what will happen there?
So on Wednesdays from 4 to 7, we will have very limited retail hours where folks can walk in and browse the bookshop, ask questions, get to know a little bit about the resources that are in our community. And then outside of that, we'll also be hosting workshops that are death community-based death care educational workshops that also incorporate elements of creativity into what we're doing there.
We are talking about death and grief support with Megan Johnson, a death worker and founder of Madison Death Studio, which is opening a store in Madison this summer. Now, you talk about a culture change. I think a lot of the time we talk about how do I personally, an individual, deal with death and grief. You're looking for something bigger, I think. How are you hoping to shift our conversation at that cultural level about how we talk about death?
Yeah, I think... Well, one of the things that kind of struck me when I was going through my own caregiving process with my family was that I was experiencing a lot of personal grief, yes. And I was noticing how that personal grief experience was rubbing up against and in tension with our culture. And also how it was running parallel to a lot of collective grief that we're all experiencing through things that are happening politically and globally, genocide, ecocide, wars, things like that. So a lot of what I want to do is actually examine not just how are we as individuals personally grieving, but how are we as a culture creating a context of grief that we are not necessarily confronting.
And so what would that look like?
So a lot of the workshops, for example, have a crossover between our own personal grief that we might be bringing to that space and the cultural grief that exists between all of us. So one example of one of the first workshops that we're opening with this summer is going to be a workshop about how to host a funeral for roadkill. And the person who's running that workshop, her name is Haley Tenner, and she works in corporate sustainability. And through doing her job, she recognized that she had a lot of personal grief that was coming up around the ecological crises, climate change, global warming, things like that. And she didn't have a place where she could talk about that. It's not something that can be individually pathologized. So she had struggled with finding a place where she could talk about that. And so she is doing her own rituals around her own eco grief. And one of them is looking at different roadkill that we have on the side of the road and then tending to it in this sort of creating this beautiful altar for the animal. So a rabbit that gets hit by a car, for example, covering the rabbit in flowers and then creating this beautiful like grass and flower mandala around the rabbit. And then she takes these gorgeous pictures. So the workshop will be exploring how she does that. What tools does she use? When does she choose to do that for an animal? And then we'll also be practicing that. And within the context of that workshop, we'll also have the experience of talking about our own personal grief when it comes to these larger cultural problems.
Another point of friction, I think, is when somebody's lost someone, A, they have that grief. B, they have to keep working. You don't get indefinite bereavement leave. And C, there's often a lot of bureaucracy, right? There's extra work to be done in dealing with the affairs of the deceased, depending on your relationship to them. Are there ways we could take some of that friction away from people at what could be one of the most difficult time in their life in some ways?
There are millions of ways that we could be taking that friction away from people that we currently are not doing as a culture. Like you mentioned, bereavement leave, which if somebody is within a certain level of inner circle to you, then you may get that 3 days of bereavement leave. That 3 days does not cover, like you said, the amount of the logistical hurdles that you have to now go through to support the death of somebody, the ritualizing of their death, the financial things that come up after somebody dies. Maybe you have to clean out their entire home. And we don't have support. We don't have readily available support for people that are going through that. You're right. There are very many ways that we can use more support in those situations.
And I know you are looking in some ways at institutional and cultural changes. At the individual level, though, I think there's often a sense that people feel like they don't know how to grieve appropriately, or they worry that they're doing it wrong in some way or another. How do you start to reassure people that there's probably a right path to grieving for them, even if it doesn't match what somebody else looks like?
Yeah, I think a lot of people have a lot of shame around the ways that they're grieving. And I think a lot of that has to do with how culture reflects our grief back at us. When we do grieve openly, how is that received? And so I think on an individual level, on one hand, it is, reassuring people that, hey, you know, there are safe places where you can talk about this. There are spaces where folks are having these conversations. And also creating larger dialogues within our culture about how we show up for other folks who are grieving so that we don't continue to create difficulty within their lives just based on our own discomfort around their grief.
Let's talk about that. You're not the person at the center of the circle of grief, if I can make up a metaphor, but you want to help that person who is, and you don't want to be a bother and make things worse. What are good ways to broach that? And I mean, we all know, like, oh, whatever I can do to help, let me know. I've said that. I know that isn't that useful. What's a better way?
Yeah, I mean, we just talked about all the whole logistical and emotional load that somebody goes through when someone dies. So offering help without any concrete way of helping can actually just create more.
Guilty. Because then they're like, oh, now I've got to do the work of figuring out how Rob can help me.
Exactly.
That didn't help.
Exactly. So if you want to offer help, you could offer, hey, on Wednesday, I'm going to bring over some groceries. Do you want to send me a list? Or I'm available to watch your kids for 3 hours on Thursday while you go do whatever it is that you want to do and take care of yourself. Or I dropped off a little self-care package. Please know that you can text me at any time. There are these other more concrete examples that we can give folks so that they don't have to do the creative labor of coming up with where would I need help. And another thing is that sometimes people don't want to ask for help because if you say no, that no can land in a really tender place for them. So asking for the help in the first place may be more painful than just not asking for it at all.
And then finally, a lot of all cultures, I think, have rituals surrounding death. We have, you know, a cemetery or memorial service, which can be great and helpful, but it's a one-off. Is there a need for more ritual that might, you know, grief doesn't go away in a day or a week. It might stay with us till we go. How can we kind of ritualize that connection with the person we've lost?
Yeah, our cultures, and by cultures, I mean all of our cultures, have rich rituals dating way, way back in our histories. And currently, we're sort of outsourcing a lot of what happens after somebody dies to institutions. And those institutions are supportive. They help us. They help us make sure that there's a place where we can have a memorial. There's somebody who can tend to the body. But these are less hands-on than the ways that we used to do them in the past. So right now, we're in a place where we do have the opportunity to recreate, to look into the past and also look into the future and maybe recreate some rituals that might be meaningful to us now.
And if I can engage in a stereotype here of us as Midwesterners, well, I don't want to be a bother.
Oh, my
right?
gosh.
Right? I got to get through this myself. Can you encourage people, whether they're, you know, they're going through the loss, they're watching a loved one and knowing they're going to pass soon, or in that time after, how can we be open to reaching out for help and then accepting it when it's offered?
Yeah. Wow. We do have a lot of that here, don't we? And I do wonder if this is just one of the things we need to crack open a little bit more, is how can we, you know, especially within this Midwestern culture, like how can we experience being a bit more vulnerable and also maybe being a bit more direct when it comes to talking about the truth and the reality of a situation? I don't think this is just a Midwestern problem, sure, though. But yes, I think, you know, we are based in the Midwest, so we can talk about that a little bit. But I think that is a deep inner work. So that is not something that we can teach in one workshop. But I think what I love about having this bookstore is that it's a consistent place where people can come and practice these things, because we're never going to be perfect at it. We're never going to be perfect at dealing with death and grief. But a workshop like this, a bookstore like this, allows us a space to try something new.
Megan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us in the studio.
Thank you. It's been wonderful being here. Thank you so much.
That's Megan Johnson, a death walker and founder of Madison Death Studio, as we heard, opening a storefront in Madison this summer, aiming to help people deal with issues of grief and death. The other day, we invited you to share your local community celebrations of the U.S. 250th anniversary.
And we got an email from Juliet in St. Francis in Milwaukee County. Juliet is part of the St. Francis Historical Society.
That group hosts an event today at 6:30 at the St. Francis Civic Center with a historical reenactor who plays Dolly Madison, the fourth First Lady of the United States, who famously rescued a portrait of George Washington when British troops burned the White House during the War of 1812.
Thanks for letting us know, Juliet. Juliet. And how about you? Are you part of a local 250th anniversary event in your community?
Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us to get in touch. The number is 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa, Trevor Hook, and Mackenzie Crummy.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Brad Kohlberg.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.